Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Banks today, big banks, and how they're trying to change their image. Also, why health insurance premiums keep on going up. And workers who maybe aren't so happy to have their jobs, even in a recession. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 4th of March, and it is good, as always, to have you with us. If you wanted to pick one big Wall Street bank to symbolize all that is wrong with big banks, you could do worse than picking Citigroup. Citi, of course, got one of the biggest slices of taxpayer cash during the financial crisis. The U.S. government remains its largest shareholder, which helps explains why the federal panel that's keeping an eye on the TARP, that is the Congressional Oversight Panel, turned its attention to Citigroup today. As you might expect, CEO Vikram Pandit defended himself and his company. He talked about all the ways that Citi is turning himself around. But what was striking about it was his tone. Our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott reports.
Throughout his testimony, Pandit smiled at the panelists, gave mostly clear answers. He even sounded grateful.
For us, as for many other institutions, the bridge to the other side, to a sound footing, came from the American people, and I want to thank our country for providing Citi with TARP funding.
Pandit is just the latest bank CEO to be grilled on the Hill. Scott Tangney is with the financial services PR firm Makovsky & Company. He says these hearings are an important platform for bank chiefs.
The current situation demands that they be politician, charmer, as well as a great spokesperson for their companies.
Citigroup, like other banks, has paid back TARP money, but the government still owns a 27% stake in the bank. Analyst Jamie Peters with Morningstar says that may explain Pandit's conciliatory tone, but she says he's doing something right.
Citigroup has gone through tremendously horrible time, you know, much more than any of the other large banks, and yet Pandit has managed to retain his job, unlike the CEOs at Wachovia, at Bank of America. We've seen turnover there.
Not all members of the oversight panel were charmed. When Pandit expressed support for some of President Obama's financial reforms, panelist Paul Atkins accused him of pandering to the bank's largest shareholder. A Treasury official told the panel the government hopes to sell its remaining shares in the bank as soon as circumstances permit. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We talked about retail a little bit on the broadcast yesterday and how there are signs consumers are starting to spend again. There was confirmation of that with this morning's retail sales report. Despite the big storms and heavy snow in some parts of the country last month, February was actually pretty good retail-wise. Overall, sales were up 4%. Nordstrom and Macy's were the big winners. And the spending continues outside the narrow confines of retail. There is some new evidence that businesses are feeling flush, too. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Turns out, while the rest of us have been spending less and saving more, so have businesses. Analysis by the Wall Street Journal finds non-financial firms in the S&P 500 are holding nearly $1 trillion in cash and short-term investments, up a third from a year ago.
Companies have slashed headcounts, cut costs dramatically.
Paul Dales at Capital Economics says as sales pick up, the money's rolling in.
They don't really just want to sit on their cash because it's not doing anything for them. It's not earning any money.
First up, mergers and acquisitions. Some companies are using their cash to buy up competitors and related businesses. They're also giving it back to shareholders in buybacks and dividends. And they have increased investment spending, rebuilding inventories, buying new computers and equipment. But will they hire more workers?
Yeah, that's the big question.
Jared Harford teaches finance at the University of Washington. He says flush corporate balance sheets could lead to more help wanted ads.
It provides that cushion to firms that are nervous about starting to hire again and expand.
But he says a big pile of cash isn't going to spur hiring on its own. Companies still want to see sustained sales growth before they commit. And Paul Dales of Capital Economics warns many companies may not need to add new workers or production lines for another year or more. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marking time, treading water, twiddling its thumbs. Take your pick. All could well have described Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Chilean President Michelle Bachelet said today it could take 3 or 4 years for her country to recover from the earthquake and tsunami of this past weekend. Bachelet's been getting a lot of criticism for not agreeing quickly enough to offers of international aid. She says what really happened is that she had to figure out what kind of help Chile needed first. Immediate aid, though, to those in need would seem to be a no-brainer. But even the simplest things can be more complicated than they seem. Sabri Benachour learned about the economics of disaster assistance in Haiti.
At Terminal Varreux, one of Haiti's major ports, a barge full of aid arrives just weeks after that country's devastating earthquake. Nobody seemed to know exactly what was on the boat or who actually sent it. One rumor was that it was from Costa Rica. Wherever it was from, throngs of men and trucks lined up for a piece.
I've been here since 4 a.m. and I haven't gotten anything.
Whoever sent the boat didn't really arrange for distribution. The boat, it turned out, had mostly packs of water bottles, which is nice and everything, but water isn't really what Haiti needed right after the quake. There was plenty of water. Sanitation equipment or rice would have definitely been more useful. This is one example of aid that just might have been hurting more than it was helping.
It really can actually do harm to an operation.
Tracy Rains is with the Red Cross.
Just to manage that and to use resources to get that in and to kind of get that out when there's a whole other way to provide water in the country that's safer, has less impact, has less logistical impact, it's really critical.
Rains remembers times when aid agencies, including the Red Cross, have had to foot the bill to store, sort, and figure out what to do with unwanted, sometimes even broken, supplies that have been sent to them. It's prevented more urgently needed things from coming in.
The trick is matching up people's natural goodwill and intention to provide support with what is really needed, what's able to be used, and how do we prioritize it.
That's why aid agencies really like cash. It's flexible. But it turns out there are a lot of ways that aid supplies can have unintended effects, and in more complicated ways than just clogging up ports. Let's say, for example, you want to give food to a country, so you give tons of your own wheat for free. Well, then you're undercutting local food producers. They can't compete with free food. Manuel Orozco heads the Remittances and Development Program at the Inter-American Dialogue. He says this has actually happened before.
During the 1980s, U.S. food assistance to Guatemala was distorting national production. In some cases, it was discouraging people from continuously to produce corn, for example.
Well then, you say, you'll just buy your donation food from the country you're trying to help. That'll spur the damaged economy. Well, that could be a disaster because you might spur inflation. Too much demand, too little supply. In the case of Haiti, inflation was already at 8% before the earthquake.
Price went up the following day.
Jean Donis lives in the Carrefour neighborhood of Port-au-Prince. He says imported products were scarce right after the quake.
The day before it happened, Coke, you could buy a Coke for $3. Now it's $4 somewhere, you get it for $5.
So in this situation, bringing in food actually helped keep prices down. Free imported rice from the World Food Program actually stabilized rice prices and, of course, fed 2.5 million desperate people. But as time goes on and as aid groups pile on needed assistance, the risk grows for distorting everything from currency to real estate prices. Again, Tracy Rains.
The Red Cross has a team right now looking at market assessments to see what the market can absorb, primarily in the food sector and in the shelter sector.
But Rains adds, the case of Haiti is pretty special. It was so poor to begin with that while economic distortions are something to keep an eye on, they're not immediately likely. Haiti can absorb a lot of aid right now. From Port-au-Prince, I'm Sabri Benachour for Marketplace.
The part of Chile worst hit by the earthquake runs from the capital of Santiago down about 350 miles to the south. That also happens to be where most of Chile's wines are produced, a not insignificant chunk of Chilean exports. Most of the wineries there are still busy dealing with the cleanup, but we did get this sense of the damage from Santa Cruz resident Matt Ridgway.
A lot of the big vats have fallen over, and that wine is leaking into the soil and into the irrigation ditches. And for the first day or so, all the irrigation ditches were stained red with red wine.
Rene Marino is the president of Wines of Chile. It's the biggest wine producers association down there. Mr. Marino, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
So have you been able to figure out how much production might be lost?
The loss of wine is around 125 million liters.
Which is how much as a percentage of the total?
It's around 12.5% of the total wine stored in Chile this year.
So not so bad, considering the scale of this earthquake.
To be very honest, we thought it was going to be much worse. Most of the wineries have moved the actual facility to make wine to modern buildings. The tanks that suffered, unfortunately, were the tanks with wine inside, so that's why we lost that many liters. The old houses still remain, but most of them remain as tourist facilities or offices or guest houses, mm-hmm. and those are severely damaged.
What about logistics, getting your grapes and your wines out onto the highways to the ports to get them to the export market? I imagine that's a little tricky.
That is another story that is a bit more complicated. The main problem today for the wine industry is taking care of our workers. And then the second problem is the general problem of the country. That means water supply, electricity, highways and ports. If that is not restored soon, then we might have bigger trouble. But today you can go from north to south. The thing is that trips that usually took 1 or 2 hours today are taking 5 or 6. Ports are working at 50% capacity, but in the end, although slow, things are going to move.
So fans of Chilean Reds perhaps should not worry so much?
No, not really, not really. I don't think we should be worrying about the supply of wine or the wineries themselves. Our main concern today is primarily our workers. Many of them lived in very old houses, and some of them are really severely damaged.
About your workers, the 80,000 or so vineyard mm-hmm. and winery workers in Chile, how are you going to get them into decent and safe housing and back on the job?
Back on the job is not going to be complicated. Wineries will start working at full speed probably in 10 days. The biggest problem will be housing. And there, we're raising money from the government, from ourselves. We're going to help our workers ourselves. We've been offered help from some people in the States, some people in the UK. I believe it's not going to be a problem of resources. It's going to be the main thing is going to be time, because it takes a long time to rebuild homes and get people back into a decent house.
Rene Moreno, he's the president of Wines of Chile. It represents about 95% of the wine industry in Chile. We reached him in Santiago. Mr. Moreno, thanks so much for your time.
All right. Thank you.
Happy just to have a job in this recession? Yeah, not everybody.
The commute to work ranks number one as the most satisfying aspect of one's job.
Not when it lasts a couple hours each way, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials jumped 47 points today. That's about 0.5%, closed at 10,444. The NASDAQ rose 11 points, 0.5%, finished at 2,292. The S&P 500 put on 4 points, about 0.3% there, ended the day at 1,122. Some big companies got analyst upgrades today. Walt Disney rose nearly 3%. Boeing ascended 1.75%. Coke poured on a 1% gain. TiVo blipped up 61% today, 6.1%, after a court ruling in the company's favor. A U.S. appeals court found that Dish Network and EchoStar digital video recording systems, they violate TiVo's patent. Dish scraped off 5% today. EchoStar still bounced up 0.2% somehow today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.6%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to updates on the economy and business, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, we get a look at the employment situation. The Labor Department reports monthly unemployment numbers. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to release its consumer credit report for January. And we can escape reality. Alice in Wonderland opens in U.S. theaters. Patrons can go down the rabbit hole as early as midnight tonight. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Executives from some of the country's biggest insurance companies met with Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius today, and she had a couple of questions for them, like what is the deal with those huge premium increases they've announced lately, and how did they come up with the numbers anyway? The official answers are probably going to take a while, so we asked Gregory Warner at the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY to fill in the blanks.
It starts with the rating manual. Every insurance company has one, but few people are allowed to see it.
Highly proprietary information.
John Vitea is an actuarial consultant. He's been hired by insurance companies to review their rating manuals. It's strictly confidential.
They make me sign a statement that says, we're basically letting you look under the hood, but you aren't allowed to go and tell anybody else what you saw.
Let's say a small company wants to buy insurance. The insurance company will use the rating manual to assess the risk of each employee based on various factors. So let's say somebody in that company is like me, 35 years old, white male living in Philadelphia. Vitea chooses a round number to start with for me. So say a premium of $100 a month.
So you start with that and then you adjust it and say, okay, if 100 is the average and I'm in downtown Philadelphia, that might be a 10% increase factor.
Because Philadelphia is a city with lots of teaching hospitals, where there are more specialists and care tends to be more expensive.
So now I'm up to $110.
But I'm a white-collar worker.
Which might be a 5% less than average.
Because my on-the-job accidents are limited to getting my ego bruised.
So now I'm down to 105. Until you exhausted all the different rating factors, then you would come out with your final rate.
You didn't think it was that easy, right? The most important rating factor of all isn't listed in any of those tables.
You can't look up a rating manual and see a factor that says adjustment for anti-selection.
Anti-selection is the enemy of insurance company profits. Anti-selection is when healthy people tend to sit out and insurance companies are left covering more sick people than they planned on. It's not a big deal in large companies where pretty much every employee, sick or well, young and old, is on the policy. But small businesses have a big turnover rate with insurers and with their employees. That's a riskier bet for insurance companies. Each year, an insurer is looking at 30% of their policyholders being replaced. Every new employee is someone who can decide whether he wants to buy into the plan based on whether he thinks he'll need it that year.
In essence, the buyer is more nimble than the insurance company.
Ed Kaplan of the benefits consulting firm The Siegel Company says, basically, you can quit them, but they can't drop you. And so insurance companies raise the price of your premiums to insure themselves against loss in case you leave them. That's the price that more and more people can't afford. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
We've been taking some time on the broadcast this week to explore the economic challenges facing African Americans. Today, the housing market. Even though the Great Recession of 2008-2009 and the real estate crash that went along with it are fading slowly in the rearview mirror, African Americans are still at a greater disadvantage than the rest of the population. Commentator Angela Glover Blackwell says that's in part because of how they were able to get into the housing market in the first place.
Compared to whites, blacks and Latinos were about 2.5 times more likely to receive high-cost, high-interest subprime loans. Nearly half of all home loans in poor communities of color were subprime. It's not really a surprise that that led to lots of foreclosures. And there's a snowball effect. Each foreclosure brings down the price of every other house on the block. Add insult to injury. Investors from outside the community are gobbling up the vacant homes. Take the minority community of North Minneapolis. Local people want to buy these homes and renovate them, but they just can't compete against outside investors who pay cash, sometimes buying property sight unseen at auctions. So we're back to square one, or maybe even square zero. The nation needs a sustainable way to make home ownership work for the people who have been shut out for generations. Low-cost, low-interest government loans and first-time home buyer plans already exist. They're a good start. But what else? We need to help local nonprofits buy and rehab foreclosed homes. That'll keep entire neighborhoods from becoming run down. Then these houses should be sold with stipulations that keep them affordable from owner to owner for decades. Such efforts are underway in cities like Oakland, California, Duluth, Minnesota, and Dover, Delaware. But it's a consumer financial protection agency that would be the best way to both deal with the scale of the current challenge and lay the groundwork for more sustainable home ownership growth for people of color. How? Mainly by ensuring that loans are explained in clear, understandable language and applicants get the best rates they qualify for. If the agency can do this, it will help level the playing field. By 2050, people of color will be the majority in America. Helping that majority become a stable middle class will require broader, more sustainable home ownership opportunities. That's a dream to believe in.
Angela Glover Blackwell is the founder and chief operating officer of PolicyLink in Washington, D.C. You can send us your thoughts. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org. The link you need is the one that says contact. At this very moment in the American economy, the official unemployment rate stands at 9.7%. That number is probably going to nudge up or down a tenth percent or two tomorrow morning when we get the February jobs report. But it's still safe to say that there are going to be a lot of people out of work. Many of the people who were able to keep their jobs through the recession are thankful for that small favor. Many of them, but not all. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
Okay. Lots of fun.
Tom and Irene Cowan are just getting back from a little cross-country skiing near their house in Plainfield, Illinois. That's about 35 miles southwest of Chicago, where suburbia meets corn country. They're both still employed, but that is no consolation.
My pay went down to about a quarter of what I was making in 2008. And in 2009, it was about a quarter of that. And I would say in 2010, it'll probably be a quarter of that.
Tom Cowan's pay has decreased, too, by half, he says. He's in real estate, but the only work he can find now is managing a construction project in Wisconsin. It takes a couple hours to get there, so he rents a crash pad.
Very long hours, more expense, just away from the family for the whole week.
Looking for other work is tough, he says, because with the commute and a 60 to 80 hour work week, there's just no time. And forget about having fun. Their last vacation?
Oh, 2-3 years ago, maybe.
Oh, it's more like five.
Oh, five. 5 years ago? Okay. Yeah, that's true.
The Cowans don't want to dip into their retirement savings, so they say they're lucky to have work at all. But Irene Cowan says the freedom they once had to work the jobs they wanted for more pay is gone.
I think I feel more like I'm stuck, like my feet are in concrete or something. You know, every time I think, well, I'll do this, I just feel like I can't make the move. You know, the insurance issue, the bills, the cutting back on different things, which is all, you know, everybody has to do it. We're all learning a different lesson here.
700 miles to the east, similar lessons are being learned by an employed 20-something in Maryland. He didn't want us to use his name because he wants to stay employed at a consulting firm. But he says work just isn't as much fun as it used to be. before the layoffs.
I think one of the biggest things was just losing a lot of friends. This was a firm where a lot of people in their 20s, a very collegial environment. And then on top of that, now we're being asked to kind of pick up the slack and doing the job of a lot of people that are no longer at the firm.
Here in New York, another worker who wishes to remain anonymous took a job at a media company in the midst of the financial crisis. She hasn't had a raise in a year.
The only thing that really keeps me going is knowing that I have a job in my field. And even though every day I'm not necessarily doing what I was trained to do, I don't feel like my skills are growing. I don't think I'm acquiring new skills. Still, I don't want to have a hole in my resume. Times are tough.
Changing jobs? Good luck, she says. And the stories go on and on. When Marketplace sent out an online request for dissatisfied workers, comments poured in from coast to coast. Lynn Franco, director of the Consumer Research Center at the Conference Board, says the stats she's seeing tell the same tale. A recent survey found the lowest levels of workplace satisfaction measured since the survey began in the 80s.
Back then, it was about 60 or so percent were satisfied. Today, they're down sort of in the mid-40s.
As employees have taken on more responsibility, often without pay or benefit increases, the difference in a recession, she says, is immobility.
More than 10% of our workers said that they don't intend to be in the same place, a year from now. But I think given the environment right now, those who are dissatisfied can't move on. And so that could have repercussions for productivity and companies' bottom lines.
And for the national psyche, listen to this tidbit from the survey.
The commute to work ranks number one as the most satisfying aspect of one's job.
Driving in traffic, perhaps, is more satisfying than sitting at a desk.
Perhaps so. Maybe it's the drive home that rates better, but I think that says a lot for the state of the American worker.
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final thought today. You know, we are not quite at tax time yet, but I'm going to see my accountant next week, which is why this item from Politico caught my eye. Congressman Jason Chaffetz, Republican of Utah, has introduced a bill that would let the government fire House and Senate staffers who don't pay their taxes. Now, before you say, as I did, come on, seriously, how many people can there be who work in Congress who don't pay their taxes? Apparently it's a lot. Chaffetz says more than 600 people who work on Capitol Hill don't pay what they owe, to the tune of more than $6 million. Best part of this whole thing? As the law stands right now, only IRS employees can be canned for not paying their tax bill. I don't make these up, folks. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 47 points, half of 1%. The NASDAQ rose 11 points, also half a percent. The S&P 500 added 4 points, a third of 1%. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on this broadcast, capitalizing on curiosity.
Being from Texas, I wasn't necessarily exposed to gang culture, and I'm fascinated by it.
Los Angeles gang tours tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that.
American Public Media.